I survey the wondrous cross on which the Prince of Glory died. My richest gain I count but loss and pour contempt on all my pride. Isaac Watts, 1707. President Jenkins, Dean Garrett, to the esteemed board members, faculty, staff, students, alums, and all friends of Louisville Seminary and the University of Louisville. To the Grawmeyer family and the Grawmeyer Award and Religion Committee, and to the Reverend Dr. James H. Cone, the father of Black liberation theology, Bill and Judith Moyers, distinguished professor of systematic theology at Union Theological Seminary in the city of New York, author of The Cross and the Lynching Tree, the distinguished recipient of the Grawmeyer Award for 2018, my mentor, on whose shoulders I stand, and on whose behalf I am deeply honored to give this lecture, The Cross, the Lynching Tree, and the Crosshairs, Racial Violence and American Christianity. The Roman cross on which Jesus of Nazareth, the Prince of Glory, the divine and human one, very God of very God, light from light, suffered and bled and died, is the primary symbol of Christianity. Its myriad representations point to and incite Christians to remember not only his death, but also the life he lived, to emulate the compassionate values he taught, to cherish the poor and suffering for whom he fought, and to expect the victory he wrought over sin and the oppressive power of death. Orthodox and Reformed traditions assert that Jesus' brutal death was a display of infinite unconditional love for the whole world and was a point in history at which the human capacity for violence reached the limits of its imaginable offensiveness to God. Moreover, because Jesus leaned into the limits of his commitment to suffering sinful humanity by dying pro nobis for us, both in our stead and on our behalf, and by rising from the dead, many of us who are gathered here tonight can personally attest that Christianity is uniquely the religion of the second chance in life and beyond the many kinds of social death a human being can experience. That fact alone should make all of our moral choices and our social interactions enlightened ones, committed to being the evangel, to being the good news, to knowing, doing, and being the prophetic and priestly truth that the world desperately needs, has always needed, and will always need. Like Jesus and the martyrdom community, the disciples and many others who witnessed to his love unto their own deaths, the cross should compel Christians wherever we live and whatever our social and economic circumstances, always, always, always to take the way with the poor, despised, and rejected, the oppressed of the land. Ironically, beginning with Emperor Constantine, whose ecumenical councils furnished the language for the religion about Jesus rather than placed emphasis on the religion of Jesus, the cross, that great symbol of salvation, came to be detached from any reference to to the oppression of human beings, the crucified peoples of history, and has been transformed into a non-offensive ornament. Rather than being a visible reminder of the cost of discipleship, it has become a form of cheap grace. In these remarks, Dr. Cone cites the Salvadorian Jesuit priest Ignacio Ellacuría and German pastor Dietrich Bonhoeffer, Christian martyrs both from the postmodern and modern eras, slain in 1989 and 1945, respectively, for their commitments to liberating praxis in and among the poor, and for them both defying illegitimate state authorities. Yesterday, April 9th, marked the 73rd anniversary of Bonhoeffer's execution for his part in a conspiracy to assassinate Adolf Hitler, who with Heinrich Himmler and Adolf Eichmann devised what they called the final solution to a problem that did not exist as an excuse to genocide 6 million Jews and 5 million ethnic Poles, Ukrainian Slavs, Soviet prisoners of war, Belarusian Slavs, Serbs, Roma, Jehovah's Witnesses, disabled people, and gay people. It is fitting that we quote Bonhoeffer at length about what God's preferential option for the oppressed in our midst means for Christians, and the gravitas, the seriousness of the Christian responsibility to carry that mission into the world that is currently in our hands. Quote, "The cross is laid on every Christian. The first Christ suffering which every person must experience is the call to abandon the attachments of this world. It is that dying of the old person which is the result of his or her encounter with Christ. As we embark upon discipleship, we surrender ourselves to Christ in union with his death. We give our lives to death. Thus it begins. The cross is not the terrible end to an otherwise God-fearing and happy life, but it meets us at the beginning of our communion with Christ. When Christ calls a person, he bids them come and die." End quote. Although our social, political, and religious landscape is currently in a state of flux, and some would say chaos, from its inception, America has been a white, putatively Christian, and most assuredly violent nation with a storied past and an undeniable presence of violence against Native tribes, against African slaves and their progeny, and against other persons of color, the immigrant communities now under watch and siege. America's identity as a Christian nation is substantiated in the roughly 70% of its citizens who still claim to follow the way manifested in Jesus Christ and that he set forth as a rule of faith. According to a Pew study published May 5, 2015, between 2007 and 2014, the Christian share of the population fell from 78.4% to 70.6%, driven mainly by declines among mainline Protestants and Catholics. Persons unaffiliated with the church, or nuns as they are called, who are a surprising mix of disaffected millennials, Generation Xers, and even baby boomers, experienced the most growth from 16% to nearly 23%. And the share of Americans who belong to non-Christian faiths also increased from 4.7% to to 5.9%. While numbers in historically black churches have remained relatively stable at around 16%, I believe there may be some masking of the problem of loss in the black church, and that what stability remains is likely due to the fact that the black church is still literally the only concrete institution that black people own and operate outright without interference from white governance over the way we worship or the content of our beliefs, which may be socially and politically progressive and theologically conservative. This is possible, and so, because the Great Awakenings helped evangelicalism bind together the Anglican, Methodist, Congregational, and Anabaptist roots of white American settlers into common religious language, and black people, too, are heirs of its platform of personal piety and its heritage of restrictive dogmas. As a black, womanist, spiritually eclectic Christian, I do not know exactly where I fit in according to this limiting template of American spirituality. I only know where I do not fit. The study reports that white evangelical Protestants, the largest group of Christians in the nation, declined slightly from about 26% to about 25% of confessing Christians during this period, but probably increased in terms of real numbers or absolute numbers since the adult population in America increased in the years 2007 to 2014 from 227 million to 245 million. I cite this report to argue that evangelicalism is the foundational Christian expression in America. It is America's civil religion, adumbrated in the fundamentalism and revivalism of the early 20th century, which in their turn and impact spanned the longest period during the lynching era. And I want to say that there is a way in which all Americans are compelled to participate in Christianity's holidays and in evangelical and fundamentalist theological presuppositions, regardless of their affiliation or lack thereof with the church or other religious communities, such as those presuppositions found in the tug-of-war debates over the need for prayer in schools, or for the government to have a say in women's reproductive choices, as if women are not agents capable of adjudicating for ourselves and serving God simultaneously. Dr. Cone's critical, conscience-stirring, and celebrated book, The Cross and the Lynching Tree, examines both Christian tradition concerning the cross and the white Christian response to the lynching era in order to discern, quote, how to reconcile the gospel message of liberation with the reality of black oppression, end quote. The lynching era was that period in American history between 1880 and 1940, from the post-Civil War Reconstruction through the early 20th century, during which white Christians whipped, shot, stabbed, hanged, burned, tarred and feathered, castrated and desecrated the bodies of nearly 5,000 black men, women, and children to great fanfare, with hardly a thought to the ways that the violence they inflicted on them mirrored the violence that Roman imperial authorities inflicted on Jesus, whom they worshiped, in whose image they presupposed themselves. Dr. Cone states, the right to subjugate the black population through lynching was grounded in the religious belief that America as a white nation called by God is a white nation called by God to bear witness to the superiority of white over black. During during slavery, white American Christians did not afford the same presumption of imago Dei or divine imprimatur to the black people that they had enslaved, describing black men as three-fifths human for the purposes of representing the voting interests of the Southern planter class. Following emancipation, they expelled the formerly enslaved people from their plantations that the slaves themselves had built and sustained through their labor. And they left them materially, economically, and physically unprotected by the presumption of the mantle of citizenship. And they left them without provision for their survival. When they were charitable, the former slaveholders rather absorbed most of the black citizenry into the agrarian economic structure of American society as a permanent underclass, as sharecroppers and housekeepers. Where they were successful in becoming something other than what white people said they could be, those who were formerly legally brutalized became targets of organized terror when the Ku Klux Klan organized in 1866. And while the terror of the Klan was not legal, it was nevertheless sanctioned by the community, supported and enacted by the local, state, and federal law enforcement agencies, by the federal troops' withdrawal of their protections after 1877, by the refusal of the Senate in 1918 to pass the anti-lynching bill, which Congressman Leonidas Dyer of St. Louis, Missouri, introduced to punish white mob violence, and not least by the imposition of Jim and Jane Crow laws that made the presumption of uniqueness that white people had accrued to themselves the basis of social relations, infractions of which, whether imagined or real, could end in a black person's getting lynched. Because I refuse to call someone president. The resident of the White House's unwillingness to condemn the resident of the White House's unwillingness to condemn the white supremacist violence in Charlottesville, Virginia during the August 2017 Unite the Right rally and his statement condemning hatred, bigotry, and violence on many sides, evokes the equivocal protection that the federal government during the heyday of lynching withdrew, and that it still declines to offer some of its most vulnerable citizens. Dr. Cohn relates that this history is something most of us would prefer to forget. Civil discourse, the hallmark of academia, demands that we not raise the subject of lynching. Civility compels us to say the obvious, all lives matter, rather than assert urgently black lives matter and brown lives matter in a context where these lives were and are clearly in constant, imminent jeopardy of the various forms of lynching resurgent in American society, politics, and economy, inherent in police and vigilante violence, and in the legal lynchings that take place in discriminatory housing, the school-to-prison pipeline, and mass incarceration, and on the world stage, in the resurgence of populism, fueling refugee crises, exacerbating the problem of human trafficking, the postmodern slave trade, civil war, and genocide. But it is more than mere civility that drives the subject of lynching further down into our collective unconscious, like the pernicious boll weevil that Sojourner Truth saw in the Three-Fifths Compromise in the Constitution That, by the way, did not even consider women's suffrage. It is also the doctrine of rugged individualism that is embedded in evangelicalism, the civil religion of the American experience, that prevents us from making the natural and sacramental connections we ought to make to each other's suffering, to each other's joy, to each other's gifts, to each other's reality. Through its emphasis on doctrinal precision, especially concerning the Bible, through its emphasis on personal piety, evangelicalism has shared Constantinian orthodoxy's promulgation of a gospel about Jesus, separated from the fact of the Roman states and these United States' engagement of long-running, ongoing wars for imperial dominance and other people's resources in the name of the Prince of Peace, then and now. Evangelicalism, as an outgrowth of the Reformation, shared and shares in its commitment to the Pauline doctrine of justification by grace through faith, which I have called elsewhere the linchpin of Protestant theology, pun intended, and which harbors individualism and morally levels every confessing Christian, whether slave or free, separating personal piety from harmful social praxis, sparing condemnation or even talk of the decimation of the native populace, or talk of the economic exploitation and enslavement of whole groups of people from many African countries, in which today church people are more scandalized by an unmarried pregnant girl congregant than by homelessness outside its doors, more scandalized by the kinds of music black people are always generating than by the targeting and censoring of black bodies in the lynching era then and now. The timing of the 2018 Grawemeyer Lecture follows a series, a near confluence of religiously and culturally significant dates. The anniversary of the execution of Dietrich Bonhoeffer on April 9th. The anniversary of the assassination of the Apostle of Nonviolence, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. on April 4th. Holy Week, the Ecumenical Church's annual observance of Jesus' death, burial, and resurrection, culminating on April Fool's Day. The shooting deaths of 26 Palestinians and the wounding of 750 others in Gaza on March 30th. The various marches for our lives against gun violence and for sensible gun laws March 24th in Washington, D.C., and various cities in the United States and throughout the world, following the shooting deaths of 17 students and faculty and the attempted murder of 17 more persons at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, on February 14th, an event that brought attention to the disparity between public sentiment for the loss of white children's lives and black children's lives, which, to the students' credit, they noted to the watching and grieving world. The march was preceded by the police shooting death of one Stephon Clark in Sacramento, California, on March 18. But in actuality, 348 others have died at the hands of police, most often having been hit by gunfire, but a few having been hit by taser between January 1st and April 8th, 2018. Forgetting these things and not connecting our ongoing struggle against lynching to the wider cosmic struggle for a just world should never be options for black people. To do so would dishonor the memory of Jesus, whom Cone describes as the first lynchee, but whom I would describe as the first lynchee whose death mattered, because there were many executions by Roman government, even two on the same day with Jesus. To forget would be to dishonor those lynched in the lynching era and those who are targeted and lynched today, whether they are seen through the crosshairs at the end of an AR-15 or a police-issue Glock or a Hellfire missile launched from a drone or other weapons of personal, social, civic, and cosmic destruction. The death of prominent, even iconic, and he would probably resist that characterization of himself, evangelical Christian preacher, the Reverend Billy Graham, on February 21st at the age of 99, while significant, did not make this list because his sunset was markedly different from the violent, blood-soaked ends and images that attend these other events in 1st and 21st century Palestine and in 21st century America. As opposed to the prolific theologian and ethicist Reinhold Niebuhr, whom Dr. Cone chastises for his equivocal support of African Americans during his time in the public eye, Reverend Graham represented the kind of immutable personal piety that society has come to expect from those who claim to be Christian. I mean no disrespect to him. God rest the dead. But his deafening and standard silence on the issue of justice for black people mitigated the difference he might have made on the American political landscape because of his widespread appeal and influence. Despite America's changing religious landscape, black people are still fundamentally Christian. Black people have always been astute exegetes of our own embodied experiences, and because of our capacity both to hear music and to evolve it, and because of the profound implications of Jesus' whole story as our collective story, we are often able to wrest joy from absurd circumstances. Cone states, "The blues and religion offer the chief weapons of resistance, where blacks affirm their humanity, and the blues offered sources of hope that there was more to life than what one encountered in the white man's world. Blues singers lifted African Americans above the troubles by offering them an opportunity to experience love and loss as a liberating catharsis. The blues reflect the endemic capacity to live, the dialectic of despair and hope, and a way to assert loudly and exuberantly their somebodiness." Although I am no beginner when it comes to the experience of grief, in a song I wrote called Purple Blues, I was able to articulate the intensified experiences of communal and personal, corporate and private grief, and to raise a standard of prayerful resistance against the unabated lynchings in our communities. In Purple Blues, I lament these extrajudicial lynchings of black children, women, and men, the trickle-down Holocaust that has always occurred and regularly occurs since the first transatlantic voyage from that massive and massively rich mother continent, Africa, to these shores. That trickle-down Holocaust that acquires fresh momentum with each black, brown, and white life lost in each mass shooting and each school shooting, perhaps as an unintended consequence of the failure to, well, regulate America's multiple militia groups, militia-minded individuals, and the failure to rein in the excess pandering to the Congress by, in my opinion, the odious and profiteering NRA. Naming is power. And in this song, Purple Blues, I express my will to be with my particular community of identity and accountability, which innovated spirituals, jazz, and blues, generating distinctive art out of our African heritage and our American experience. Through my song, my devotional aspect, and my way of being in the world, I continually demonstrate fierce alliance with life across the cosmos, and conversely, I condemn white supremacist, heteropatriarchal, oligarchical, curiarchal, and other forms of the machinery of death against which the genre of the blues speaks, not civilly and not sadly, but defiantly and even joyfully. This is especially true of the subgenre of blues known as the jumpin' blues that came to prominence in the early 1920s due to the jouissance and popularity of artists like Mamie Smith, Ethel Waters, Alberta Hunter, and the Empress of the Blues, Bessie Smith. During this period prior to the Great Depression, the federal government had again utterly failed in its civic duty to protect its black citizens from white racial violence by refusing again to pass the Dyer Anti-Lynching Act in 1922. From Jerusalem to Ferguson, to Charleston, to Parkland, to Sacramento, to everywhere people are whipped, shot, stabbed, hanged, burned, tarred and feathered, castrated and desecrated. The earth is sotted with the blood of the innocent victims of lynching. James Cone teaches us to remember them, to question the role of the Christian religion in keeping these events and systems of oppression in place, and to recognize that Christianity that does not militantly side with the oppressed can never be normative. For more than 50 years, Dr. Cone has mentored at least as many students and taught many more in America and abroad. It was my privilege to serve as Dr. Cone's research assistant for 5 of the 10 years I spent at Union. I have so many stories I could tell you, but I will tell you only one. Like many of you, I came to seminary believing it would be a process of confirming me in my already held beliefs, which were shaped by evangelicalism to a surprisingly greater extent than I could discern, not having been raised initially in the church. I thought being a Christian had to do with cultivating quietude, piety, charity, and a practice of service so that one could experience beatitude and perhaps be useful to the realm of God. Week after week, I sat in Dr. Cone's course, ST-103, the foundational course in systematic theology. I found myself experiencing a new, angry edge I had not expected and was hearing in my voice. It was something to which I was not accustomed, and I realized that my theology was shifting. One night, in the middle of the night, I was shaking with anger because of all the things I had to wait to get to graduate school to learn about my collective history, because these things were not spoken about in civil company. I picked up the phone and I called Dr. Cone. Yes, in the middle of the night. He answered, and with tears in my eyes and in my voice, I told him how angry I was. He listened attentively, and finally, graciously, he said to me, "Joanne, your anger is going to save you." After my stunned silence passed, he said, "Now don't ever call me at this time of the night anymore." So that is my strong advice to you. That you find your anger about these things. That you not let guilt short-circuit your efforts to find and do the truth. For over 2 millennia now, the life-affirming narrative of Jesus Christ has called upon Christians to exercise our will and right to love ourselves, to love others, and to love God. In his whole story, particularly in the authentic passion of the Christ, we are called upon to become the children of God, to be agents of justice who risk brokenness, and to be sacramental witnesses of the steadfast love of God for us, and to let anger save us for the work of love in, with, through, and beyond our brokenness to signify our hope of the ultimate victory of love over hatred, justice over oppression, and good over evil beyond the grave. Thank you.